This is Angle of View. Today is April 21st, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. So look, I'm really, really busy with some things I can't tell you about yet, which is why I've been gone the last 2 weeks and also why I can only get through today's episode and the next few by deploying a contingency plan that I devised in secret when the show first started. Coverage of new releases is hereby suspended until further notice. Broadcasts will consist instead of reviews of older movies, where older is defined in terms of the show's history, to mean before 2024. For fun, I will indicate the date that I wrote the review, as well as, to the best of my recollection, which viewing the review accompanied. There is, of course, a chance of me being in the right place at the right time to catch a new release or two at choice points over the next few months. If that happens, and if I can also cheat my way into some real writing time, I will be more than happy to share my thoughts with you. But for the most part, the show is going to have to pull out of the vein of the contemporary for a little while. Who knows, maybe it'll be good for me, akin to one of those overdue sober stretches. Contemporary movies are a lot like drugs, actually. They cost too much, they give you terrible hangovers. The only thing that's missing from the analogy is that before the hangover sets in, most drugs actually make you feel good. Anyway, how will I choose which reviews to pull out of the drawer and blow the dust off? Well, surely you would agree that one of the most valuable things a critic can do is champion something underseen and stimulate new interest in it. And so that is exactly what I am going to do later, perhaps. In these early episodes, out of a desire to keep you listening, I'm going to do the perfect opposite of that and talk about Barbie and Oppenheimer. Barbie, 2023, directed by Greta Gerwig. Review date, July 25th, 2023. First and only viewing. The most charitable reading of Barbie is that a major woman artist looked back on her youth spent playing with Barbie dolls and was able to express her complicated feelings about Barbie as a totem of womanhood in a way that, quite by chance and happily, was conducive to Mattel's marketing and advertising strategy. The least charitable reading of Barbie is that amid the extremely disheartening rising tide of movies about products, Mattel, in nabbing a talent like Greta Gerwig and in personifying the product rather than just venerating its inventor, simply made the smartest and most interesting movie about a product so far. Here's the thing, though. The gravity of the cultural event that is Barbie is so strong, and its surface so slippery, that you have only to stare at either of those two readings for a few seconds before it morphs into the other. It's all one perfectly inscrutable, ungraspable, diamond-hard object, impervious to interpretation. American culture's biggest and most official encounter yet with the phenomenon of the product that comes bundled with a critique of itself. With every critique of itself, actually. Anything you could think to say about it, it says first, displaying an almost childish determination to win every such race, and nya-nya about it. Every possible audience response is anticipated and articulated and reabsorbed back into the product faster than you could form it in your own head. By this hyperactive cleverness, you aren't permitted a personal experience of the movie. As with any strong ad, exhaustive pains are taken to ensure that nobody will experience it differently from anybody else. The only critical thoughts which would resist this power are the ones that you knew in advance would never be granted oxygen in a Mattel production, e.g. about plastic waste, labor conditions, and the other material ways in which this product leaves everlasting impressions upon the earth. Because the movie has become such a big deal, treating it like a regular movie feels totally inadequate. It's a phenomenon, above all else, a post-postmodern actual celebration of capitalism, which has given us, as a grotesque bonus, the sideshow of pointy-headed dorks like me dusting off their theory books to decode a movie about the Barbie doll in the middle of a summer in which every new day is the new hottest day in the history of the planet. Welcome to the exact future that the 20th century Marxists warned us about. Anyway, we've got a fascinating artifact on our hands, but it's not really anything to be happy about. Oppenheimer, 2023, directed by Christopher Nolan. Review date, July 23rd, 2023. First and only viewing. Everything Christopher Nolan touches takes on instantaneous heavy importance. So I, for one, am glad that he started reaching out to subject matter that matches this vibration. This is almost certainly one of the reasons that Oppenheimer is the best movie he's ever made. His pre-existing and inflexible tendencies toward the somber finally have real soil to till. The undergirding of both the story and the telling are actually so strong that this movie proves which of Nolan's problems are the truly untamable ones. They're the only ones that still show through the fabric. His ideas about what makes good editing are blinkered. That's perhaps the one aspect of his filmmaking that didn't grow up here. This movie is cut to the same fast but rather ponderous rhythm that he taught himself through his action movies, and it works against not just the total pacing of the material, but the basic strength of the shots. We never ever linger on anything, even though we have production values that deserve to be shown off, and material that is meant to arouse not just contemplation but torment. The shot selection, per se, is not bad. You can quibble with Nolan's seeming preference for tight shots on the grounds that it seems an odd use of 70mm, but a lot of the real story takes place in small rooms, so it fits. More importantly, when you're meant to see a magnificent southwestern panorama, you will see one. He knows that the montage has to include establishing shots, and the problem isn't how he frames those shots, it's the fact that he cuts away from each of them within a second and a half. The camera always urgently needs to be somewhere else, always chasing action in medium and close shots, even though the action is mostly dialogue, and this dialogue is generally so solemn that it's jarring to be hurried through it. Some of this falls to the way Nolan directs the actor's delivery, but it's mostly an editing problem. It's just not an adequately patient film. Imagine a James Bond movie in terms of tempo and pulse, something with that kind of machine gun crispness, but it's a 3-hour political drama. And imagine that its scenes are packed with so much talk, most of it expository, that the frenzied pace makes it seem more like 4 hours of movie squished into a 3-hour container. But now, for extra fun, imagine that it's actually compelling, in spite of all this. Imagine that it does, successfully, organically, interrogate the scientist's definition of progress and accompanying motor drive, and shows you that moral blindness that takes hold in the throes of discovery, and the terror of the reckoning that crashes down later, weighing all the more for the delay. Imagine that it's as fair and penetrating a reckoning with this phenomenon, and with the spirit of a man broken by it, as a Christopher Nolan script could ever have been hoped to provide. It actually connects on these intended levels, and it's in large part because, amazingly, the dialogue, Nolan's own, is almost always strong, even as his direction undermines it somewhat. It has to wrestle with a different problem in its last hour. The engine stalls out as the investigations take over the story, and the rooms become so oppressive that it threatens briefly to make the movie boring. But it is saved from that fate by the dialogue managing to keep its edge. And it's got another wonderful quality to thank for its success. Cillian Murphy, the beautiful rodent with the brilliant blue eyes devastated by incurable sadness. The conscience of Murphy's Oppenheimer is eternally ruined, and it shows in his face in a form of pure anguish that becomes poignant on sight by the end. It's a performance crushed to a small pipsqueak size along with the character, and it only gets stronger as it gets smaller. And although all the real action is compressed into one sequence, the Los Alamos detonation, the sequence is magnificently daring, the sound mix of the explosion putting the character's anxious panting in every nook and cranny of the mix so that the experience becomes terrible and sexual. The widely lauded auditorium sequence is also very stirring, and it's rather amazing that its risks are rewarded. The high feelings that these sequences get at and achieve represent exactly the kind of thing I feel like I never could have expected from Christopher Nolan before. These are also the two sequences in which that otherwise inappropriate editing approach works unequivocally in his favor. It's in these sequences when you feel most strongly that he not only finally chose the right kind of story for his disposition, but he actually expanded his disposition in service of the story, finding his way to a new kind of manic fervor. Oliver Stone, that's who this feels like. The same brand of especially righteous paranoia, of a history lesson all jacked up on fear and anger. It's not quite as deep as it thinks it is, which is a problem Stone also used to have, and it's far too impressed with its own casting. Every new performer's reveal is treated with a bigger workup than the previous one, and in how most of these great character actors are used, the reveal seems to have been 9/10 of the point. They're like SNL walk-ons. As a matter of fact, this is also a problem that Oliver Stone used to have. Strong exception here, though, for David Krumholtz, who has gained extraordinary presence in middle age, possibly on his way to becoming the next Michael Lerner. I could keep picking nits, but what matters most is, this is the first time Christopher Nolan has ever dared move beyond a pure machinist's technique and tried to put some blood in. It's a welcome change. The King of Comedy, 1982, directed by Martin Scorsese. Review date, October 4th, 2023. Probably third viewing. Transcendent discomfort. Discomfort sublimated into something purifying, as if for an ascetic. There has never been another movie protagonist like Rupert Pupkin. He seems more like a character from 1960s American fiction, Barthelme maybe, or Coover, in how completely unaware he is of how society works and the composure with which he goes about his backward business. Watching someone with that combination of confidence and cluelessness move through the world in any capacity makes you twist up your face cringing. The Office, in both versions, had multiple characters like this. But watching that person in pursuit of a show business career, deciding that his very first step should be to gatecrash his universe's equivalent of The Tonight Show, is so harrowing a level of cringe that you somehow emerge feeling cleaner about humanity. Our ranks may be full of lunatics and creeps, but no real person has ever acted like that. But just because nobody ever has, does that mean nobody ever could? After all, Rupert is ultimately reducible to a stalker. And stalkers are very real and almost always have weird ideas about what they deserve. Rupert is motivated not by a purely egotistical fantasy of becoming a famous comedian, but by a fantasy of entwinement with Jerry Langford, of being his heir in comedy and receiving the torch from him in an extremely public way. Most stalkers have elaborate visions in their heads about the nuts and bolts of their eventual togetherness with the object of their obsession, exactly what they'll do together after they have been united and where, what they'll be wearing, every line of the script for their conversations. To the most minute detail, they know what they want their victim for. The character of Masha, though likely thought up initially for plot reasons, insofar as an abduction requires more abductors than abductees, ends up being most powerful as a foil for Rupert in this regard, the stalker whose desire for the stalked is more traditional. She wants Jerry for sex and wild nights out, which is her idea of love. You see her and think, that's a stalker. And then you look back at Rupert and think, but what's going on with this guy? But Rupert's operating on his own idea of love. To him, being recognized as a great stand-up in the mold of Jerry Langford is achieving intimacy with him. It's the culmination of a lifelong tribute. I could see somebody having an idea that weird. Robert De Niro has a way of holding his face in this little pursed smile that's unique to this performance. De Niro's real smile is broad and beautiful and brings a shine to his eyes, but Rupert's smile, especially under that mustache, is completely different, almost officious, like a magazine ad model. It's a device that gets more impressive the more you stare at it because it represents how much faith Rupert has in himself. Despite seeming to be completely incapable of engaging in real communication with another human being, he enters every encounter led by that proud and pleased smile, always looking already victorious. By the end, as he gets improbably closer to achieving his goal, it's funny just on sight. De Niro is, in truth, the funniest he's ever been in a movie here, finding the most beautiful little glinting comic touches in his delivery of his most absurd lines, while still able to turn up the temperature of Rupert's encounters with Jerry, using a quality that approaches real scariness. In his single most glorious moment, he is forcing Jerry at gunpoint to call his producer and put him on the show. After the producer's secretary mistakes Jerry for a crank-calling impressionist and hangs up on him, Rupert, having previously been thrown out of the building twice, says, "I'll let you in on a little secret. That's the same way they treated me. And now look where we are." The movie's most glorious moment, though, belongs to Sandra Bernhard as Masha, finding herself so ecstatic at having Jerry as her captive at last, taped to a chair across her dining room table, that her ideas about how to express her glee come too fast and with too much firepower for her to handle. Scorsese expands into a new technical power yet again here. The static approach to interiors that didn't work in Raging Bull, because there weren't any ingredients in the pot, here becomes a magnificent source of escalating awkward tension. Everyone who spends time with Rupert is in essence trapped with him, and this only comes to feel more nightmarish under Fred Schuller's frigid lights. Eraserhead, 1978, directed by David Lynch. Review date, July 5th, 2025. probably sixth viewing. Eraserhead, David Lynch's singularly mesmerizing debut feature, is his most fully realized movie. I can never decide whether I think it's his best altogether, but it's the one in which the elements are most effectively and organically united. At a glance, this risks appearing like a facile comment to make about a movie that took 5 years to complete. One had damn well better be committed to a movie to spend that much time on it, and this goes not just for Lynch, but for everyone else involved. Imagine being Jack Nance and having to maintain that haircut. But 5 years is also more than enough time for a vision to fall apart, or slip out of the artist's grasp. That production time could have become a great big stage for doubts about the project to play out on, or accumulating frustration at the prolongation itself could have driven cast or crew to get impatient and break off to join simpler films. Or just as easily, the thing could have simply dissolved. One day everybody could have shown up on set having forgotten what they were doing when they started out. It's a profound testament to David Lynch's command as a director that Eraserhead not only escaped those ill fates, but is so magnificent a fusion of forms and ideas that it makes that notorious gestation period seem almost as though it had been necessary, like the film was a ceramic piece that required an especially long firing in the kiln, or else it might not have held its shape. Naturally, it was because of practical constraints, severe limits on budget, space access, and cast and crew schedule management that it took so long to make, but to watch it, you wonder whether the aesthetic world of the film would have ended up this beautifully articulated without the gift of that time, whether a story this far out of the orbit of ordinary movies could have been given the same stunning confidence of presentation had the cast and crew not effectively lived inside that world for as long as they were forced to. Ultimately, the movie is not a mere showcase of that world as a made object. It is an organic experience of it, and from within, the experience of someone born there. How cheap words seem when applied to something like this. It doesn't penetrate the skin of Eraserhead by a centimeter to call it weird or gross, though you could hardly be blamed if those words took up your forebrain on first viewing. Nor would you get there by tacking on more adjectives, scary or angsty. Its theme is domesticity, and parenting specifically, as life-ruining nightmare. And its visual language is one of the most earnestly upsetting hells ever dreamed up in a movie, a nauseous mix of organic and industrial abominations which find their nexus in the choice to render all the houseplants and trees as dead sticks stuck in dirt piles. But as that image partly indicates, it's also really, really funny. The exigency to which Henry, Nance, has had to sacrifice his life, the insatiable, unutterable needs of his monstrous infant, without exaggeration the greatest creature in the history of special effects, is a suffocating horror. But the life he's left behind for the baby's sake doesn't much seem worth missing. Henry's dinner with his girlfriend and her parents is a hilariously bad time, even before he learns about the baby. Nor does the fantasy life he imagines in the radiator seem beautiful except by comparison and within the same ghastly aesthetic confines. Real beauty is foreclosed, just as real comfort and safety are. The way the film symbolizes the baby's conception is grimly mechanical. Levers are pulled and giant spermatozoa fall from Henry's mouth through space and into a milky lake, like an art installation. But the way it symbolizes copulation bends this same vocabulary to tender erotic ends. When Henry has a dalliance with the beautiful woman across the hall, another milky lake materializes in his bedroom, and they slip down into it together, leaving just her hair floating on the surface. The film is visually so fertile and spectacular that it seems a contradiction for it to be able to hold such a wealth of images within such strict limitations of scope and setting. Those limitations, along with the binding cloth of the incredible haunting sound design and omnipresent noise floor, which is the oral complement to the visual aesthetic, the gray howl of a machine having a bad dream, give it an inspired focus and wholeness. We'll be back next week with reviews of some more classics. I don't know which yet. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews and writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.